7. This is the 8 a.m. agenda, although we're a little behind our game because we had a 7 a.m. agenda, which we've just concluded. So let me roadmap where we're headed. There are three bills set for public hearing, House Bills 2415, 3319, and 2381. House Bill 2381 will not be heard today. The proponents of that bill are going to work on it further for probably not this session. So that bill will not be heard. If you're here for House Bill 2381, you can take off. We're going to take the other two bills in order. It is my intention to complete the public hearings on the two of them by 9 o'clock so that we have an hour for the work sessions that are the remainder of the agenda. I know we have a lot of people signed up, I'm going to try to be fairly, insistent about brevity, and I've got a timer here that I'll need to invoke for some people probably. So I open a public hearing on House Bill 2415. Representative Butler.
The committee 2415 comes in. Representative Butler prohibits sale, transfer, delivery of firearm or explosive to a visibly intoxicated person, prohibits gas stations, garages, and selling Class 1 flammable liquids to persons who are visibly intoxicated, prohibits sale, transfer of motor vehicle to person who is visibly intoxicated.
Senator Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to hear this important piece of legislation. This bill comes about as a result of a very unfortunate incident, but not one that hasn't occurred before, nor will it be one that happens that doesn't happen again if we don't address the issues. This bill relates to sales of property, of certain types of property, to visibly intoxicated persons. Some folks wanted to make it a gun bill. It is not a gun bill. It deals with a whole series of kinds of dangerous things that visibly intoxicated persons may have the otherwise legal right to receive. I've invited to the dais with me this morning Officer Andy Willard, who is a police officer, was with the Ontario City Police at the time of the incident. I'll let him go ahead and explain his situation and how this bill came forward. And then I've also invited Andy Moyer, a member of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, to testify as well. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Willard. Representative Butler said I'm a former police officer with the City of Ontario. I'm currently with Oregon City Police Department. February 4th of 2005, Ontario officers were dispatched to an attempted abduction of a 17-year-old courtesy clerk at our local Albertsons, where she sustained physical injuries. She was dragged by her hair across the parking lot and thrown into the back of a vehicle by the suspect. She was able to actually free herself from the vehicle and run and scream and get away. Upon our arrival up at the scene, through some video surveillance and past contacts with the suspect, we were able to determine who he was and where he lived. After a few attempts, the sergeant and I were down there. We weren't able to locate him. We went back to review more video. While we were reviewing video, I went back out to the residence to attempt to locate the suspect. As I got to the house, he wasn't there, turned around, went down the street, and as he was coming down the street, or as I was going down the street, he came onto the street, turned on him, activated my emergency lights, and he didn't pull over until he got to his residence. As soon as he got to his residence, he exited his vehicle with a firearm, ordered him to drop the firearm. He didn't drop the firearm. Subsequently, I shot and killed him. He died later on at the hospital, but while at the hospital, his blood was drawn, and his BAC, or blood alcohol content, at the time of the shooting was a .279, which is 3.5 times the legal limit to even operate a vehicle in the state of Oregon. Further investigation by the Oregon State Police showed that the suspect had bought the gun in Ontario at a local gun dealer at 5:57 p.m. local time, which is exactly 10 minutes from the minute that I shot him, which was at 6:07 p.m. local time. He also purchased bullets along with the firearm. So the point of it is that it was obvious that he was intoxicated at the time that he purchased the firearm. Not only that, but there were also open alcohol containers in the vehicle, stun guns in the vehicle, which led to basically the kidnapping is what his intent was to do, obviously. And we Also, after the investigation from the state police, it showed that he did not own any firearms prior to that. His witnesses, close family friends, showed that he wasn't a firearms guy, and he did not possess any firearms. So, thank you
very
for
much.
The opportunity.
Mr. Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll keep my testimony brief. I just want to let the committee know the Oregon State Police Officers Association supports House Bill 2415. And just to back up what this officer from Oregon City, who used to be Ontario, said, that this bill isn't just about the sale of a firearm, but also explosives as well as a vehicle. It just doesn't make sense that it's legal for someone to go into a car dealership, whether it be a used car dealership or a new car dealership, if he's visibly intoxicated, purchase a vehicle and drive off the lot, putting everyone in danger. Almost worse than that in that case is that you know that they're going to be putting someone in danger because they're going to be driving away, versus the sale of a firearm or a explosive. There's a high chance that they may put someone in danger, but with a vehicle, you absolutely know that they're going to be putting someone in danger. Remind you that 40% of all fatal traffic crashes in Oregon, which are about 500 every year, are alcohol or drug-related. In conversations with legislative counsel yesterday, we were trying to determine if there's a statute defining visibly intoxication. Just for your information, we could not find any statute that defines visibly intoxication or Oregon administrative rule. However, we all know that this is not just someone who has a drink or two, but we all have seen people that you can say right off the top, oh, that person's drunk or that person's intoxicated. And that's what this bill is intended to. If you know if a person is obviously intoxicated, that person probably shouldn't be purchasing a firearm at that moment, or an explosive, or definitely not a vehicle. This isn't necessarily put into place as what Representative Butler says is a gun bill. This isn't a cooling off period. This just says if you're intoxicated, you shouldn't be at that moment, mainly for your own protection, since alcohol is a depressant, is you shouldn't be buying a firearm or an explosive or vehicle. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. Again, there is a Dash 1 amendment, which, and I'm not certain whether you have it in your possession at this time, but we have worked this bill both with the Senate side to allay any concerns there that it would be tampered with, and it's my understanding that with the Dash 1 amendment to bring the violation to a Class B misdemeanor, at this particular point that you could hold a work session, advertise and hold a work session on House Bill 2415. This would provide additional protection for folks who would otherwise be selling gasoline. My background, in addition to being an accountant, has been in the fuel delivery business, and we had a very strong policy in our businesses that when we were servicing, unfortunately Oregon is one of those states where you have to get them out of the vehicle to get them to go pay for the service, and once you know that they're visibly intoxicated, we could usually hold them up at the front desk until we had a responding police officer from the local jurisdiction coming in and interdicting on our behalf. But right now there's absolutely no ability for an employee to say, you know, I really don't think that you ought to be getting gas and driving off of our parking lot, because number one, you're liable to take out somebody on our private property, but number two, by the time you get back on the highway, you just aren't capable of functioning. So this will provide additional protection for those folks who would prefer not to serve a person who is visibly intoxicated and put fuel in their tank or deliver keys to a new car to them. It will also provide that those people who have legal licenses to buy explosives in the state of Oregon, if the explosives dealer recognizes that they are visibly intoxicated, it provides them the protection to say, I will put this in the storeroom and a store magazine, and it will be ready for you tomorrow morning. Please have either come in and pick it up tomorrow morning when you're in better condition, or have somebody else come and pick it up for you when you can't be driving around with this explosive yourself. So this covers a whole variety of the issues, and again, this has been vetted on the Senate side with the judiciary there, and the good senator has indicated that this is a bill that they would like to see go forward. So I would strongly encourage you to consider in a work session the -1 amendments and pass 2415 to the floor. Thank you very much.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Butler and panel. I have a question. I don't care who answers it. I'm just wondering about the practical application. If somebody who's intoxicated pulls into a gas station and is not the kind of gas station where you have to get out of the car. I don't like to get out of my car to pay. But if they want to stay in their car, and the person who's working there comes over and senses that they're visibly intoxicated, just how are they supposed to handle that situation? Are they supposed to say, sorry, you can't get any gas, you're drunk, and then go in and call the police? Or just practically speaking, how would that situation be handled?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the bill does not address how that actually happens. It basically provides an opportunity that you do not have to service that person if you recognize that they are visibly intoxicated. Again, it would probably be station-by-station policy. Our policy was to get them out of the vehicle, have them come to the front desk. There's a problem with your credit card. Can we please have you come to the front desk, at which point we would call a local police? That's a station-by-station policy, I guess, is what I'm telling you.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We have the law about serving visibly intoxicated people at the bars, but we, part of that require the bartenders all are trained. And I don't know how we would train gas station attendants. I mean, at least in the metropolitan area, those are pretty itinerant workers. I mean, guys come in and out. And so, I mean, that would be a major concern is one thing. And then the other was the different, I saw different levels of fines. Didn't make any sense to me. Why? I mean, if I can buy a case of dynamite, why would that be less than or more than one or the other?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Barker, you're absolutely right to go out and train folks to identify visibly intoxicated persons, and I have had people contact me relative to this bill and say, my husband's a quadriplegic and he could be mistaken to be a visibly intoxicated person, but he should have the right to buy a firearm. At that particular point, there would be no preclusion from a sales clerk going to their sales manager on their sales floor and saying, this person in the wheelchair is intent on buying this firearm. This person in the wheelchair has a license to purchase explosives, and I can't tell whether or not they're visibly intoxicated. It merely gives them an opportunity to get a second set of eyes and ears involved in it. It does not discourage them from training their employees to at least getting a second opinion as to the person's state.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that question briefly?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, talking with legislative counsel yesterday, as well as far as the different class A or misdemeanors for the different phases of the bill versus the firearm and the explosives in the vehicle. The legislative council got those punishments from separate statutes. In other words, the unlawful transfer of a firearm that is a Class A misdemeanor, so they just added that. The explosives is a Class B, so they just added that to this bill rather than making them all the same punishment. And I don't understand if there's a way that they could make them all the same class would be perfectly fine with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel. Just taking an order, Kevin Sterrett. And it's my intention to complete the remainder of this within, say, 8 minutes. So I'm going to start a 2-minute clock here, I'm afraid, because we have to get on to other business. Mr. Sterrett.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Most of what our concerns are with this bill have been addressed by some of the questions that brought up. But essentially, people who are in the business of serving alcohol have to be trained in this state to determine when someone is when someone is drunk. If this training is required for people who are just serving drinks, then it's hard to imagine why it wouldn't be required for somebody who is selling a firearm or explosives. We also don't understand why, as has just been questioned, why the levels of penalties are different, since certainly a person who buys a car is far more likely to do damage because he's drunk than a person who has purchased a firearm isn't necessarily doing anything with it. So The required training is a real concern of ours, because it's not only firearms, licensed firearms dealers who are affected by this, but any person who sells a firearm privately. And I know that, having worked as a bartender for a long time in New York, it's sometimes very difficult to tell the difference, as has been brought up here, between somebody who is intoxicated or somebody who has possibly a speech impediment. And so we're just really concerned that, while we're not supporting selling any of these items to people who are drunk, that, as has been pointed out, visibly intoxicated isn't even defined in Oregon law. And so we think that this has the potential to be a problem unless those issues are addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Sterrett. Any questions? Then Anita Phillips and Donna, it's like a Dish? Yeah, very good. Come forward, please.
Chair McPherson and members of the board, for the record, my name is Donna Dish.
I'm Anita Phillips. I'm the licensing manager at the State Fire Marshal's Office. You have our outline and the list of our concerns, and in the interest of saving time, we'll certainly try to summarize this and let you get on to the next person. We don't support or oppose House Bill 2415, but our concern is the misplaced authority that it places upon our office. We believe that the regulatory authority for this bill should fall to the OLCC. They, at present, provide training to people on recognizing visibly intoxicated persons. They do it at convenience stores, many of which are associated with gas stations. They do have the training out there now, and they are providing that. We do also regulate the prohibition of self-serve and commercial fueling. We don't visit the approximate 3,500 stations in Oregon because we have a very minimal staff to do our other inspections and investigations. And then additionally, we also regulate a portion of the explosives industry, but we don't have the authority to regulate the sale or purchase of explosives. That falls upon the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So we just wanted to point this out, that we believe that OLCC would be the appropriate agency to regulate this training on visibly intoxicated persons, and also to enforce this portion.
Very good. Anything to add to that?
Yes, I'd just like to wrap up a comment, Chair McPherson, members of the board. This does fall outside the scope of authority of the Office of State Fire Marshal, and we believe that for the efficiency of the bill, it does need to fall to OLCC and law enforcement.
Very good. Any questions? Thank you very much. Marie Severson.
Of the committee. For the record, my name is Marie Severson. I'm the manager of the firearms unit of the Oregon State Police. I feel redundant here today, because what I came to say was that we have some questions about how it would be determined that a person is visibly intoxicated, who would be responsible for making that determination, and how would they be trained to handle that. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Severson? Thank you very much. Ron Harder.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron Harder with the National Rifle Association. I'm certainly not here advocating to sell firearms to drunks. My main concern is the definition of visibly intoxicated. It does not appear in the law. We're going to ask a 17-year-old gas station attendant to determine what that means and how they are going to go about enforcing it. I think that the training is so far out of sight as far as training all these people involved that it's absolutely without any kind of merit to even suggest that we could possibly do that. Finally, in the last section of the bill where it talks about relief from liability, I think it would raise my comfort level if this bill were to go forward, to have some kind of relief from civil liability to people who were involved in refusals. In other words, if somebody refused to take one of these actions and refused to make the sale, that the person would not be able to bring a lawsuit against the person doing it. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. And finally, Paul Romain.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. We're not the serving side of this one. We are opposed to the provision that talks about sale of gasoline to a visibly intoxicated person. You went through a bit of it earlier, but there are many ways that people buy gasoline. Unfortunately, one of them is not self-service, but maybe in my lifetime we'll see that. But the way people do, or the way I do, is I drive up, I'm still in the car, I hold my credit card up, person, and I say, fill it regular, and they take the card, and they come back with the receipt, and that's basically it. There's really no opportunity. If a person gets out of their car and actually has to go into a place to pay, you might have an opportunity to see whether or not they're intoxicated. You might not have seen them even drive up. This bill does not give you the option of selling. You have that today. You have that under current law. You don't have to sell gasoline to somebody who's a danger. There is no way. This makes it criminal to sell the gas. That's the problem. If it simply gave us the option, which we don't need because we already have it, we wouldn't have a problem with it. It's just very difficult for us to deal with something like this. We appreciate where the sponsors of the bill want to go. Nobody wants to sell gas or anything else to a visibly intoxicated person. We don't want that danger out there, but this is just impossible for us to even attempt to comply with. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Romain?
Mr. Chair, real quick.
President Cameron.
Mr. Romain, back in an earlier day in my life, I remember having something to do with the gas station, and I remember, this was back in the 80s, I thought there was a civil suit for somebody who actually did pump gas to a visually intoxicated person, and do you have any recollection of that here in the last 20 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I really have no recollection of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, that concludes all the testimony on House Bill 2415. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2415. We'll move to a public hearing on House Bill 3319. And pause for a moment while the change of counsel.
19.
Listen up.
Thank you.
Tell us about House Bill 3319.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3319 concerns Oregon's prevailing wage rate law. Oregon first passed its prevailing wage rate law in 1959, and it's modeled after the federal Davis-Bacon prevailing wage laws. The prevailing wage rate law is designed to ensure that contractors compete on their ability to perform work while maintaining community-established compensation standards. BOLI is responsible for administering and enforcing the law and for educating contractors, subcontractors, and public agencies about its requirements. What HB 3319 does is require awards of attorney's fees to prevailing defendants in prevailing wage suits initiated by BOLI. It establishes that contractors or subcontractors who fail to pay their workers the prevailing wage may be liable for unpaid wages, including fringe benefits, but only if the contractor or subcontractor was notified of the prevailing wage requirement in the request for bids or the contracting documents. The bill establishes that contractors or subcontractors may be liable for an additional amount equal to the unpaid wages if the failure to pay was intentional. The bill also establishes that public agencies may be liable to workers on public work projects for their unpaid wages, including fringe benefits, and the penalty wage for intentional conduct if the public agency was subject to the state and federal prevailing wage requirements but failed to include the required information about the prevailing wage in the specifications for the public works contract.
Thank you, Council. Let's bring Joe Schweinhart and Randall, Tosh forward from the City of Salem.
And while I still have your attention, there are dash ones before you also. They clarify the manner in which the public agency may notify the contractor of the prevailing wage requirements, and there also is a prior referral to Business and Labor.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Randall Tosh. I'm the city attorney for the city of Salem. We support 3319. In fact, it was introduced at our request. It would make three essential changes to Oregon's prevailing wage law. The first change is that under current law, if Boley brings an enforcement action and the public agency loses, then the public agency has to pay Boley's attorney's fees. On the other hand, if the public agency wins, Boley does not have to pay the public agency's attorney's fees. And so it's a one-sided prevailing party fee. This is highly unusual. If you look at prevailing party fees, they are usually two-sided. It's the loser pays. We think that this is a fundamentally unfair provision in current law, and in fact encourages tactics that are designed to increase the public agency's attorney's fees. And I can give you three examples from a recent case involving the City of Salem and Boley. City of Salem and Boley are in a dispute over the whether or not prevailing wage applies to the Salem Conference Center. Initially, the Urban Renewal Agency and Boley had discussions about where the case should be filed. There was a determination that either Multnomah County or Marion County would be the appropriate county. Prior to filing the lawsuit, the attorney for the state consulted with the agency's attorney, and the agency's attorney said that he believed that the appropriate place for the case would be Marion County. The next day, the lawsuit was filed in Washington County, a county that's only relationship to the lawsuit was the fact that there was one subcontractor that had an office in Washington County. This tactic ended up increasing the agency's legal fees by about $50,000 or $60,000. So we believe that the current law as it stands punishes the public agency for being correct in its interpretation, and that changing the law to award attorney's fees to the party that prevails in an enforcement action will ensure that Boley's interpretations of prevailing wage law are based on the legislature's purpose and intent. The second change would make it clear that a private contractor is only liable for payment of prevailing wage if the contractor had notice of the requirement in the contract documents. And the idea here is that under current law, it's essentially a strict liability proposition for the private business. And the private business would be liable for the payment of prevailing wage even if the private business was unaware that it needed to pay prevailing wage. And we submit that this is unfair to private businesses and that the proper party in that situation for liability purposes would be the public agency. The third change would change current terminology from liquidated damages to a penalty wage. Liquidated damages is a term of art in contract law. It reflects the concept that if you cannot determine what the damages are, the parties can agree to an amount that would be paid if there was a breach of contract. The actual damages, prevailing wage hasn't been paid, are the amount of the unpaid wage. So we would submit that the term liquidated damages is legally incorrect, and that really what you're talking about is a penalty wage. And if it's going to be a penalty wage, then we would submit that the penalty wage should be imposed if and only if it's an intentional violation of the law. And we would also submit that it should be discretionary on the part of the court so that the court can weigh different factors in terms of whether or not the penalty wage is, in fact, appropriate. And that being said, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Representative Barker. Thank you. There was a case up in Portland several years ago where there was essentially a public housing project being built to be shipped up to Alaska. And the contractor said, I don't have to pay prevailing wage on this job. And so, of course, there was a lawsuit involved. So they built it with non-union, contract people built the building. They were shipped off. Then it was found that did come under prevailing wage. The contractor, I assume, had to pay the prevailing wage. And so under this bill, they wouldn't have had to pay that. Is that correct? Because they didn't know ahead of time.
No, that's There was no predetermination in this particular situation.
Yeah, there was argument ongoing, but there was no predetermination.
That is correct, but the public agency would have to pay the prevailing wage. So there will be a party who will be liable. It'll either be the public agency or the contractor. And if the contractor doesn't have any notice that they were required to pay prevailing wage, they wouldn't be the proper party in the lawsuit. The public agency would be.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tosh, in your written testimony at the bottom of the first page, you say if a private business has to pay the unpaid wages plus a penalty wage and BOLI's attorney fees, even though the private business had no knowledge of the requirement that prevailing wage must be paid, is there not the opportunity to get a predetermination about whether prevailing wage is going to be paid?
Well, there are several problems with the predetermination. One is that it's been taking quite a bit of time in cases where there's a dispute over the application of prevailing wage. I can say that in the city of Salem, we've had three separate predeterminations that have taken over 6 months to get a response from BOLI. And a lot of times these projects are moving very quickly. And with increases in construction costs, it's necessary to get one quickly. The second thing about predetermination letters is they're not final orders. They're not appealable. So that if the parties have a dispute over whether BOLI was correct in its interpretation of the law, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to review those. If BOLI were to issue declaratory rulings, which it has authority to do under the APA, that wouldn't be a problem. But BOLI has declined recently to issue a declaratory ruling that was requested by the City of Salem.
Thank you.
And the other thing about predetermination letters is because they're not a final order, BOLI could change its mind, even though the parties have entered into contracts based on those representation that it was or wasn't a prevailing wage project.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tosh, you also indicate when BOLI adopts a new theory without prior notice, the private business can face substantial financial liability, even though it acted in reliance on both the representation and prior applications of law. In your experience, has that occurred with some level of, or perhaps I should say, what level of frequency does that occur?
We believe that BOLI has adopted several changes to his interpretation of prevailing wage law in the last 3 to 4 years that have attempted to expand the coverage of prevailing wage law. I would say that probably the first instance where there was an expansion or a new theory was the Salem Carousel, which involved a donated project. The community got together to build the carousel, and as a result of a complaint that was filed, I believe, by an electrician, BOLI subsequently determined that they believed that that was a prevailing wage project. That was a new interpretation, a new application, and so the parties would not have been aware that that would have been a prevailing wage project.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll excuse this panel. And we'll be calling up Dan Gardner, Commissioner of your
Mr. Industries. Chairman, if I may, just a few words. Joe Schweinart, City of Salem. This is a process bill. It's not a public policy bill, and it's about fairness. And we would urge you to not only approve the bill, but instead of referring it to business and labor, where the chairman has already said he's not interested in hearing it, send it to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schweinart. And while Commissioner Gardner is coming forward, let me announce that the work session that was scheduled for today for House Bill 2909 will be rolled over until tomorrow. The stakeholders want a little more time to talk about the issues in that bill, so we will be carrying that work session over until tomorrow's agenda on House Bill 2909. Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. For the record, here in opposition to House Bill 3319, let me first point out there's a fiscal on this of up to a couple of million dollars a biennium based on the recent Salem case where they're asking for an award of $600,000 of attorney's fees. Let me just point out a few things. First, where it comes to attorney's fees, other than in a couple of cases where it was part of a negotiated settlement, there is no history of the Bureau of Labor and Industries getting attorney's fees when they prevail in a case. We do not have a history of that. secondly, you know, this is a matter of where a party chooses to enter into a lawsuit, which is very different than an enforcement action by the Bureau, which is totally different in nature because the Bureau is bound to enforce the laws that the legislature presents before it and gives it authority to enforce. We are required to do those enforcements. Third, this bill provides, you know, an absolutely unbelievably generous opportunity for an award for attorney's fees. The Bureau of Labor and Industries, for instance, we are required to use the Department of Justice. We're limited in our ability for expenditures by legislative action. In this particular instance, with the City of Salem, when we first entered into it, and I had a meeting with Mr. Tosh, the city attorney, it was very clear that he was absolutely not in agreement with the Bureau. It was very clear that we were going to enforce and he was going to sue the Bureau. My comment to him was, my God, let's go about this in the way that's least expensive to both agencies. Let's agree on a statement of fact, go through an administrative hearing process, issue a final order, which is directly appealable to the Court of Appeals. Our attorneys, through the Department of Justice, and this is in the court record, went about a process of trying to get them to agree to that, which they declined and went about court action, to which, as I said, they've ended up spending $600,000 so far, according to court records, hiring 14 different attorneys. Fourth thing here is that most prevailing wage cases are cases of enforcement that are tied to claims that are part of the contested case hearing process, which operates under the APA rules. This is distinguishes their enforcement from frivolous and retaliatory, which is brought about in good faith. Basically, we are required to follow those rules. We are required to follow different sections of law to make sure that we are in accordance with the statutes that we oversee. If we are outside of those statutes, currently attorney's fees could be required against the Bureau. Basically, this is an unnecessary bill, and I think I'll just end it there, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Commissioner Gardner?
Thank you very much.
So we have Amy Joyce from ODOT signed up, and apparently that's not Ms. Joyce, so take her next.
Chair, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, handed in some written testimony. To summarize, we'd like to commend to you the -1 amendment, which essentially would codify a current practice, an agreement that we have with BOLI, to allow the wage rates for BOLI and the federal rates for us to refer to the websites that exist that contain those wage rates. When the legislation passed in 2005 requiring the inclusion of wage rates, we started sending out in our bid documents and our contracting documents a 300-page book that included the various wage rates for the various trades on a public works project. So all we're asking for is a codification in the -1, that current practice of referring folks to the websites, which frankly have the most updated wage rates, which change sometimes weekly, so that folks know what rate they should be paying. And that is what we ask for.
Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Joyce. I'm going to close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cameron.
I heard one of our testimonies from Mr. Garner mentioned something about procedures with Mr. Toss, and I'm wondering if he would like to respond to those comments
Let's
that were made.
Let's get Mr. Toss back forward then.
Thank you, members of the committee. I would like to clarify what did happen with the lawsuit. Initially, the BOLI met with the city, and there was an agreement between the city and the Attorney General's office to attempt to come up with a way of resolving the differences through litigation that would be inexpensive as possible to both parties. And we initially agreed that we would go through a declaratory judgment process. Upon subsequent research, we determined that declaratory judgment process was in fact not available because it was a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, and that a court would have dismissed it. And a dismissal could in fact have occurred as at the Court of Appeals or at the Supreme Court if it was subsequently discovered. So as a result of that, what happened was Boley ended up filing an enforcement action against the City of Salem, or the Urban Renewal Agency, the owner of the hotel, and all of the subcontractors, even though Boley conceded that none of the subcontractors had any notice of the fact that there was a requirement to pay prevailing wage. In fact, during the course of the litigation, while the motion for a change of venue was pending, Boley filed notices of intent to take default against all the contractors and subcontractors. And one of the attorneys for one of the subcontractors asked Boley's attorney, well, why are you doing this now? Because there's a motion to change venue that is pending, and Boley's attorney told the attorney just to be ornery. So I believe that Commissioner Gardner's characterization of the course of litigation is incorrect, and in fact the City of Salem and the agency have tried to the greatest extent possible minimize the costs that are incurred in the litigation, because we are aware that the statute is a one-sided prevailing parties fee, and the notion that we would be simply going about this to increase our attorney's fees is quite frankly ridiculous. We have petitioned for attorney's fees under a provision in the APA that allows for an award if an agency has acted with no reasonable basis in law or fact. That's a very high standard, and we do currently have an attorney petition for attorney's fees pending in circuit court because we did win our lawsuit in circuit court. Our attorney's fees that we've incurred to date are in excess of $600,000. The size of those attorney's fees are a result of Boley's attorney's own litigation tactics in this case. There was a similar case that was litigated in the City of Portland involving what's known as the Tin Roof Project. The legal issues in that case were no more complicated than the legal issues here at the City of Salem, and the attorney's fees that were incurred in litigating that case were approximately $200,000. So I take serious offense at the characterization of the agencies, the City of Salem and the agency's tactics in this case. We have tried to minimize the cost of public agencies. I've been representing public agencies now for 14 years and have been appalled by the tactics they have been used in this litigation.
Thank you, Mr. Tosh.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I don't have a question. I just want to comment that we received just during this hearing a lengthy letter from the Office of State Treasurer raising some concerns about this bill. And so in light of another bill that was passed by the House already. And so I'm really encouraging that we don't work this, because I haven't had time to process this, and it raises some pretty serious questions about the applicability to other agencies, and just a big issue that I think we need more time to wrap our minds around.
Representative Cohn.
Chair McPherson, I agree with that. I mean, now we have Boley involved, ODOT, and the state treasurer. This is a troublesome bill.
Mr. Chair, one last comment about a fiscal cost of this bill. There is a fiscal cost of this bill, whether we pass or not, and it's here locally in the City of Salem. And the art of confusion sometimes is a very good art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are all the comments. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3319. Committee, we have a number of work sessions that are still on the agenda, and with the exception of House Bill 2909, which is being rolled over, we will be taking the other work sessions here in order. And so we're going to open first a work session on House Bill 3233. Changing of the guard here for a moment.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 3233 relates to the creation of the Sex Offender Treatment Board and Sex Offender Treatment Advisory Board. House Bill 3233 makes legislative findings regarding the evaluation, treatment, and monitoring of sex offenders. It establishes certified sex offender therapist, certified associate sex offender therapist, and certified sexual arousal interest examiner, and provides specific criteria for such certification. House Bill 3233 creates the board to certify and to maintain a registry of such certified positions and to develop evidence-based standards and practices for treatment and monitoring. It also creates an advisory board that makes recommendations to the main board. House Bill 3233 provides for confidentiality in the communications between certified therapists, examiners, and their patients, with some exceptions. Exceptions include patient's consent, legal actions, statements regarding criminal intent, and information regarding victims who are minors. There are sanctions for persons that falsify certification. The board appears to be funded through such sanctions and through the collection of fees from persons seeking certification as therapist examiners. There's a Dash 3 amendment, which my understanding, among other things, it declares an emergency and alphabetizes definitions, and it also places the board under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. If there is anything else that the Dash 3 does substantively that I'm missing, I believe that Ms. Hutanen could address that.
Ms. Hutanen, why don't you come forward and respond on that point.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. There are just a couple of additional changes.
And start by identifying yourself for the record, just so we have that on tape.
Sorry about that. My name is Heather Hutanen, and I am the training director for the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. There are just a couple of additional changes in the Dash 3, and as you'll note, this is in essence replacing House Bill 3233, the Dash 3 is. So just in terms of making sure that it's not so confusing, it appears that the order of things has been changed, but in terms of content, the content and intent of the bill have really remained the same, but line for line it looks very different than 3233. In terms of additional substantive changes, we added a couple of pieces of language at the request of the Oregon Youth Authority and those who work with juvenile offenders or youth offenders, just to make sure that our language appropriately mirrors both the juvenile and adult systems. And then on page 5 of Dash 3 amendments, line 7, we changed the language specific to a training requirement, and this was consensus language working with sex offender treatment professionals as well as the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and their constituents.
And do the Dash 3 amendments then supersede prior ones, so that's the only set we need? Okay, any questions or discussion on House Bill 3233 and the Dash 3 amendments? And do I hear a motion on the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments in House Bill 3233.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3233. Is there any discussion of the motion?
Just the fact, Mr. Chair, did we just get these this morning?
Yes.
And you don't have opportunity to really read it and see if there is substantive change that you know. They're saying there's not. That's fine.
Yeah.
Be careful about getting them so quick and not having an opportunity.
A point well taken, Representative Krieger. The process has been a consensus project, I think, all along. There really hasn't been any, characterizing that accurately, Ms. Hutanen, that there hasn't been any opposition along as we've evolved. It's really been trying to refine the ideas.
Exactly. And I think just to further address that as we have reviewed the original bill and then the amendments, sometimes there are technical pieces that the folks in the field, the experts in the field, have raised concern about whether they work with youth offenders or adult offenders, and it's certainly been our interest and effort to make sure that we address those issues. I'm certainly not an expert in this area, and so this has been very much stakeholder-driven.
Sure. Chair McPherson, for the record, could the witness tell us who is the hour in this consensus building? So that gives me a little more clarification who was involved in the amendments.
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp. The hour is the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, which is comprised of about 225 members representing prosecutors, civil legal attorneys, victim advocates, sex offender treatment and management individuals, among a whole host of other folks. In addition to that, we've been working very closely with the Oregon Adolescent Sex Offender Treatment Network, and you may recall that we had John Harkins, who's the president of that organization, who testified in support of this bill the week before last. Additionally, we have the Oregon Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, who also was at the table the week before last. We have been working with them. We've also been in conversation repeatedly with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, with the Oregon Youth Authority, and with the Juvenile Directors Association, as well as the Oregon Community Corrections Directors Association.
I can see why she used our, but I really do appreciate the clarification.
And if there's anything to add, Ms. Schenkel, that would be fine, but we don't feel under any need to do so.
I just want to make the record clarify. My Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice, and Ms. Cunahan was explaining this, but just to be very clear on behalf of our work with Ann Christian and the OCDLA, there will be another work group that our department has agreed to facilitate. There are some remaining technical concerns that we haven't had time to talk all the way through. We have done consensus amendments to this point, but we will continue the conversation. So I just want to assure the committee that we are dedicated to continuing the conversations. Also, in response to Representative Krieger's comment, this is page 2. I tried to do a Hannon Gross for you. There's no way you could read the Hannon Gross because, as she explained, it was put in a new order, but the substantive changes she has described, and we're happy to follow up with anyone. We did go through it line by line this morning to give Darian an update.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Quick question, thank you. In regard to the fees and charges that are referenced on page 10 of the dash 3s, and they're established by the agency under this section, subject to the prior approval of Oregon Department of Administrative Services, and can you give us just a little bit of information about that?
It's my Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, it's my understanding that the Oregon Health Licensing Agency has a formula for establishing whatever the certification and renewal fee will be, and that's based on the size of the group of people who would be asking for certification, that they have a particular formula. We've estimated that there are approximately 300 people who would be eligible or interested in this. And they have estimated, and again, this is just an estimate at this point, that the certification fee would be approximately $200.
Any further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I want to thank everyone who's worked so hard on this. It's a very important bill. I support it completely. I just want to reiterate my concerns about, let's not forget about prevention as well as treatment. So, thank you.
Okay. We have a motion on the dash 3 amendments, do we? Yes. Representative Barker moved the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3233. Unless you think we need to more input here now, Ms. Christian. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Ann Christian with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. I apologize. Ms. Elkanich appeared on this bill before, and she just informed me that there was no opportunity for OCDLA to provide any public testimony on this bill at the time, simply because time ran out. My second sentence of two is, we will be working with Department of Justice, and I do join with the proponent with respect to the fact that we both need the people who do this work at that meeting, which we have not had to date. Thank you.
Very good. So noted. Thank you, Ms. Christian. We have a motion before us to put the dash 3 amendments into the bill. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? And the dash three amendments are in. And I'd be looking for a motion to pass the amended bill out of committee with, and then on to the Ways and Means Committee where there's a prior referral.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3233 as amended to Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3233 as amended with a due pass recommendation and with, for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Representative Kump.
Just clarification, Chair McPherson. I think we've heard it both ways now that the criminal defense lawyers were part of the pronoun our discussions. And then we heard that they weren't now in the last couple of comments. So,
well, I think what we heard was that they didn't have time to present to us in public hearing
before.
Apparently, it was one of those days where we had a very crowded agenda. But I think what I'm understanding is that they have been in the discussions that is through which this product has evolved.
The providers haven't been.
I'm still seeing hesitation. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Mr. Chair, Ann Christian again, and I apologize. We OCDLA still has some concerns that the Department of Justice and the proponent are aware of with respect to this bill. They have agreed to have a meeting on that one issue as far as having evaluators who perform evaluations other than by one method that is covered by this bill. So we... OCDLA is not, at this point in time, I can say, in support of this bill.
Okay. Appreciate the clarification.
I'm just technical on this. Were you or were you not at the table, though?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kump, I would say that we were at the email table.
Okay.
And that this bill then had the abbreviated public hearing about week and a half ago.
I understand that.
And we raised our concern.
Thank you.
Very good. Let's see, we have not the dash three amendments in.
They are in,
and we have a motion to move from committee with a due pass to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kump.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chairman Corson.
Aye. House Bill 3233 moves from the committee with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3233 and open a work session on House Bill 2560.
Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson, members of the committee. House Bill 2560 relates to the felony driving under the influence of intoxicants. Under ORS 813010, that establishes the elements for DUI law in Oregon. In short, most DUIs are Class A misdemeanors. To rise to the felony level, ORS 813.010 sub 5 requires that the person have three prior DUI convictions within 10 years prior to the date of the current offense. Since successful completion of Oregon's diversion program does not constitute a conviction, diversion does not count towards that number. House Bill 2560 changes the rules for felony DUIs in the following two primary ways. First, it eliminates the in the 10 years prior language. Thus, three lifetime prior DUIs is enough for felony DUI in Oregon. Second, it effectively counts diversion from Oregon or any other state towards the total number if that diversion happened within the prior 10 years.
And Council, are there amendments to this bill, or has it come to back to us as originally printed?
It comes, Chair McPherson. I have no amendments.
And there's a prior referral to Ways and Means, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. The committee, the only issue on this bill is whether it has a cost that would be troublesome. As a policy matter, it seems to me that counting prior diversions toward felony DUI is good policy. It's just a question of whether it's cost too much. So I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 2560.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2560 with a due pass to Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2560 with a due pass recommendation for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Thomas.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisniewski.
Excused.
Chairman President.
Aye. House Bill 2560 moves with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session, House Bill 2560.
Yeah.
And open a work session on House Bill 2349.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2349 relates to presumptive life sentences for certain persons committing sex crimes involving forcible compulsion. House Bill 2349 makes life without the possibility of release or parole the presumptive sentence for certain sex crimes involving forcible compulsion anytime the defendant has a prior sex crime involving forcible compulsion. The bill applies only to the following crimes, and again, to repeat, only where those crimes involve forcible compulsion: rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and sexual abuse in the first degree. ORS 163.305 sub 2 defines forcible compulsion as compelling someone either by 1. Physical force, or 2. An express or implied threat that places a person in fear of imminent or future death or physical injury to the person or another, or to be in fear of being kidnapped. House Bill 2349 does not apply to a defendant under the age of 18. However, if the defendant is over 18 but previously received an adult sentence for a prior forcible sex crime when he was under 18, then the sentence enhancement still applies.
Committee, this was before us in hearing recently, and we got, I think, useful input on it from Joe O'Leary from the governor's office, who's back here today, and we could hear more from him if you had further questions after that summary that you just got.
Good job.
Okay.
Bill should pass.
Okay. Well, your motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2349 to the floor if the due pass.
Actually, it would be going to Ways and
Ways
Means. Another situation.
Prior referral, right.
Yeah. Representative Barker moves House Bill 2349 with a due pass recommendation for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisniewski.
Excuse me. Aye. House Bill 2349 moves with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2349 and open the work session on House Bill 2350.
House Bill 2350 relates to the crime of kidnapping in the first degree. ORS 163.235 defines the crime of kidnapping in the first degree, which is a Class A felony, generally as involving the following elements: taking a person from one place to another, or secretly confining a person in a place the person is unlikely to be found. That's the first main element. And then secondly is the mental state, the intent, with the intent of one of the following four: compelling the payment of ransom, holding the victim as a hostage, causing physical injury to the victim, or terrorizing the victim or another person. House Bill 2350 adds a fifth intent possibility to that second element. It adds the language of with the intent of committing rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, or sexual abuse. And for rape, sodomy, or unlawful sexual penetration, the crime would need to be by force or with a mentally incapacitated person.
I have a question.
Representative Bonamici.
For counsel, or maybe for Mr. O'Leary. This 2349 had a presumptive sentence, but this one has a mandatory sentence. Is that correct?
Let's hear from Mr. O'Leary.
And if so, if there's a distinction, I just wonder why. Why they're different.
For the record, Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski, Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that is correct. The sentence enhancement in House Bill 2350 that relates to kidnapping is an amendment to the current statute that codifies Measure 11, which is a mandatory minimum sentence. Conversely, House Bill 2349 is an amendment to the presumptive life scheme statute for three prior felony sex offenses.
Just the one.
follow up?
Go ahead.
Is there a reason why there's a difference in those two approaches that you know of?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, the to the extent I think I can articulate a difference in crafting it, it was crafted to be consistent with the existing statutory structure in each of the respective statutes in which we were suggesting to place these amendments. Current existing law under 137, I think it's 170, the Measure 11 statute creates those mandatory minimums. The kidnapping enhancement enhances one of those and keeps it as a mandatory minimum, whereas the sex offender enhancement in 2350 is amended into a statute that presents the opportunity for a court to impose a life sentence if it so chooses.
It wasn't a separate policy choice that we should be having a mandatory minimum. It was a reflection of an existing policy choice that has already been made.
Chair McPherson, I think that's absolutely accurate, and I don't mean to my answer does not suggest that you shouldn't have a discussion about whether or not those choices are appropriate.
Any further discussion on House Bill 2350? This too has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2350 with a due pass to Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2350 with a due pass recommendation for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on that motion? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this bill because of the... certainly believe that it's egregious and we need to punish people who are convicted, but I do hesitate in expanding mandatory minimum sentences without more information about how they're working. And if you read the cover story in the Oregonian on Sunday, the amount of money that we're spending on prisons, we need to take a good look and make sure that we're taking the right approach. So I'm going to support the bill now, but urge us to be cautious about our approach in the future on expanding mandatory crimes.
Thank you, and I appreciate those remarks. In this morning's Oregonian, there's an editorial, which I was expecting the other shoe to drop, regarding that. And they seem to take more of an aim at the upcoming long sentences for property criminals. They, in this editorial, pointed out that there are successful reductions in violent crime by Measure 11.
Thank you. Just didn't have time to read the paper yet.
Before 7 a.m. meeting.
Get up before the sun.
That's right.
And committee, there are some challenging policy decisions that are facing our legislative session. We moved already to Ways and Means a combination of repeat property offender legislation and changes in alternative incarceration programs that have a significant fiscal in them, and so that kind of puts into focus as we have moved forward a policy choice to spend more on property offenses and certain other kinds of crimes. There's a question of how much we should be spending in the aggregate on corrections. Yeah. Representative Krieger.
The difficulty is we can't quantify the long-term savings by dropping the recidivism rates, and that's the key, what we're trying to do.
Yeah, points well, very well taken. So we have the motion before us to move House Bill 2350 to the with the due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Is there any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Pong.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnik. Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
House Bill 2350 moves to the due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2350. I'd like to reopen work sessions on House Bill 2349 and 2560 for the purpose of suspending the rules so that Representative Wisnik can vote on those bills. Those are back in work session. ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules to permit Representative Wisnett to vote on House Bills 2349 and 2560. Any objection? So ordered. Representative Wisnett, how do you vote on those bills?
Aye, and I apologize to the committee for not being here.
That's quite all right. We've been stalwart on this long session, Representative. Reclose the work sessions on House Bill 2349 and 2560. Now open as our last piece of business, because as announced before, House Bill 2909 is being rolled over. House Bill 3313, opening a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3313 was heard by this committee on March 29th and concerned a super priority lien for local governments who need to secure and decontaminate and certify as fit for use properties that have been declared to be a nuisance because of illegal drug activity. There were some dash twos that came before the committee, I think, was given to the committee right when the hearing started, so there was some confusion over what the dash twos were trying to accomplish, and there are now dash threes, which I believe are a consensus product between the makers and the proponents of the bill, and I'll quickly describe what they do. The dash three amendments replace the original bill. They require a county or other local government, before incurring costs, to decontaminate the nuisance property or have the property certified, to provide notice to each owner and lien holder for the property. The bill provides the owner or lien holder 60 days to propose a course of action to decontaminate and obtain certification for the property within a reasonable time. It requires the public bodies to suspend efforts to decontaminate or obtain certification for the property if it receives a course of action that may be reasonably expected to achieve the decontamination and certification of the property. The bill allows the public body to resume decontamination if it determines, after an opportunity for a hearing, that the proponent who had proposed the course of action had failed to pursue the course of action. It then establishes that a lien for costs incurred by the public body to decontaminate and certify as fit for use has priority over all other liens and interests in the property, so long as it complied with the notice requirement and no owner or lien holder responded to the notice, or the owner or lien holder failed to complete the course of action within 8 months or longer if agreed to by the public body.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
I think we have a consensus product here, and I'm going to look out to Mr. Austin and other folks who are representing the stakeholders, and they're nodding yes, so I think we've kind of brought this together on something that people are comfortable with. Any questions or comments? No?
I would just be ready to move the dash threes into House Bill 3313.
I will take that as a motion to move the dash three amendments into House Bill 3313. Any objection? Discussion of that motion? Any objection to moving the dash three amendments? If not, the dash three amendments are in the bill.
Was there a subsequent referral on this one?
There's not.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3313 with the dash three amendments to the floor as a due pass.
Representative Kump moves the dash three amendments. The House Bill 3313 with the dash three amendments, or as amended by the dash threes, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Flores.
I would just like to say I know this has been a very significant concern for Clackamas County for a while now, so I'm gratified by the stakeholders who have worked with Clackamas County to bring this to some level of good resolution.
Very good. I echo those comments, too, being another proud member of the Clackamas County delegation.
Yep.
Any further discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Paul. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chairman Frozen.
Aye. House Bill 3313 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Flores, since this is for Clackamas County, would you be willing to carry it?
I'll take it for the team.
Terrific. I thank you for that.
Thank
I've closed the work session on House Bill 3313. Because we rolled over that last item, which was going to consume the rest of our time, we are done early, committee. Thank you very much for some hard work today. We are adjourned. Oh, planning on 8 a.m. It's a long agenda, but I think we can roll up our sleeves. I would plan to do it at 8 a.m.
Barring that we not short-circuit any input and discussion.
Very good. I appreciate that. That concludes our agenda, representatives. We're adjourned.